The printing presses in Italy are running almost as hot as the pizza ovens, and for good reason. From Palermo to Milan, no morning ritual in this part of the world is complete without your daily newspaper. But can a paper-first mantra still compete with today's seemingly voracious appetite for non-stop news? We'll find out today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis. I'm Tom Edwards. Also on today's programme, I'll speak to the editor of the California Sunday magazine, Douglas McGray. And a little later, I'll also be checking in with Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé.
There is a very unique relationship that you have between that tactile snap between the fingertips and I think how that's transmitted through nerve endings up to your brain.
But we start in Italy. When it first hit the streets in the mid-70s, La Repubblica boasted a distinct lean to the left. It quickly gained popularity with members of Italy's Communist Party and eventually became a serious competitor to Milan's Corriere della Sera, some 100 years its senior. Today, the paper has mostly shed the radical left agenda in favour of a more centred, moderate position. And this year, its weekend magazine supplement, Il Venerdì, is celebrating 20 years in print. Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to the magazine's reporter-at-large, Riccardo Stagliano.
I've been here since the last 8-9 years, and before that I was working in the foreign desk of the Daily, La Repubblica.
And Il Venerdì, since when does the magazine supplement exist?
Since 1987, meaning that this year we will celebrate its 30th anniversary.
Oh, so it's
30 years.
It's like Monaco, we're celebrating 10 years, you guys, 30 years. That's amazing.
Yes.
Riccardo,
yes.
But let's talk about this week's issue. I have the cover in front of me, which is a Deliveroo driver, which is a scene that I see quite a lot here in London. I'm not sure how's the situation in Italy. And you're also the author of the cover story, which is about the gig economy, correct?
Exactly. In fact, this photo was shot in London because I was in London a couple of weeks ago reporting on this particular story, which is the story on how the gig economy is striking back in a way. Something very new happened in London because a tribunal recognized that the work of the so-called riders of the food service industry, like Deliveroo or Foodora or Just Eat, you name it, there are many of them, in spite of the claim of the company that they are independent contractors, they're not, because they are rather workers. They are under the strict control from the owner of the platform, who decides the price they are paid, the price that the restaurants are paying, and it's the interface that puts the riders in touch with their clients.
I have to say, I mean, living in London, of course, I've seen this news, every time about, especially about Uber. But is the gig economy as big as here in the UK, in Italy, for example?
No, not yet. I would say, to start with, Uber has been declared, at least the most famous part of Uber, Uber X, which everyone can become practically. A driver has been declared unlawful by an Italian tribunal. So, I mean, it's very, very tiny in Italy yet. But we are seeing more and more of Deliveroo-like services. In fact, this cover story is partly reported in London and partly in Italy, especially in Turin and in Rome, where a couple of months ago there has been a huge vocal protest of some Foodora riders who complained for the fact that their hourly pay was replaced by on a delivery basis pay, which changed, of course, their income and the fact that they were, if they didn't do any delivery in an hour, for instance, they didn't get any money, but they were still working. That ended up in a harsh confrontation between the workers and the company.
Riccardo, now talking about other stories that you did for Il Venerdì, which type of stories? I mean, of course, now I know you did this very good article about the gig economy, but tell us about other examples of interesting stories you did for them.
Yeah, I have to say that they cover a broad spectrum of current affairs. I'm lucky enough to be a kind of reporter at large, meaning that I cover really very different stories with particularly foreign stories, but not necessarily so. The last but one story I've made was about Sweden going cashless, meaning that it's harder and harder to be able to pay with cash in Sweden, because apart from credit cards, of course, but they have got a bunch of other electronic payments like app, by which you can not only pay at the stores, but you can also exchange money peer-to-peer with other guys, and which is very convenient. It's very interesting from an Italian point of view, because we don't have anything like that, but we are probably the European, with Greece, the European champion of tax evasion. And the fact that we pay in cash highly facilitates our tendency to evade the taxes. And so it was an article talking about Sweden, but it was meant for the Italian politician to realize that there are other ways to behave, probably which would be much more efficient in fighting the tax evasion, which is a huge problem in Italy. Or the last few months I've interviewed Werner Herzog on his last movie about the internet, a movie quite critical vis-a-vis of the internet, or Tom Wolfe, the writer, about his last book, in which he pitched a fight towards Noam Chomsky about his generative grammar theory, and so on and so forth. I've done many different things, as you might see. But what I would like to say about the Venerdì, not particularly about me, is that the Venerdì is a magazine which has always put, from its very beginning, culture, in a very broad sense, also in a popular sense, but culture at its core. We do a lot of book reviews, but even when we don't do book reviews, books are often at the core of our articles, or they are the starting point for an idea. Of course, once again, also from the examples I gave you, we do current affairs, but we try not to be on breaking news that much. We tend to focus on stories that keep new also in some weeks, if not some months, that stay fresh for a long time, I would say.
Absolutely. So, for example, your story about the gig economy, I guess you had, you know, quite a few weeks to prepare the story. It was not like deadline is tomorrow, you know, just one day to do it, for example.
Yes. Luckily enough, we are on a very good and luxurious spot. We can afford to stay 1 week in the place in which we are reporting, and then another week before, in order to prepare the field we are going to cover, and so on and so forth. I mean, me particularly, but other reporters here and other editors, we are avid readers of The New Yorker or of Harper's and of many other great weeklies in the world. We tend to take our time. I know this is becoming rarer and rarer in the journalistic field, which is plagued by spending reviews and cuts to the budget and so on and so forth. But luckily enough, the Verdi is doing very well so far, and they let us go on the field, take planes, book hotels, and take our time to do the best story we can possibly do.
Fantastic and well-deserved. And very quickly to end, Riccardo, you're mentioning about how the magazine covers culture quite a lot. I was looking at the other stories covered in this issue, and then, excuse me, my Italian is not that good, but there's a story by Antonio Gnoli about Tony Servillo, the Italian actor, right? I'm a big fan.
Oh, yes. He's a great actor, of course, and Antonio Gnoli is a very good. He used to be the former editor of the culture section of La Repubblica, so he's a very talented interviewer. Tony Servillo is not afraid to say, is one of our best actors, very well known for his association with Paolo Sorrentino, Oscar Prize with the Great Beauty, and Servillo is a kind of fetish actor. He's basically done most of his movies, and it's a great interview.
You're with The Stack on Monocle 24. California Sunday are two words that seem to slot together, well, just perfectly, conjuring images of lazy days spent reading in the sunshine. It was the perfect name for a weekend supplement, a magazine to be found inside the LA Times and the San Francisco Chronicle, distributed throughout, well, California on Sundays. Douglas McGray is the co-creator and editor-in-chief of the California Sunday magazine. And Douglas joins us now. Hello, Douglas. Let's go back to the beginning, always a good place to start. And tell us a bit about the origin story here, because I guess this is a bit of a, I don't know, it's a good news story for print, isn't it? And it's about how maybe some contractions in other parts of the industry can create opportunities if you have a good enough idea.
I think that's true. I was working as a writer and a radio producer, writing long magazine features and making radio documentaries. And on the side, as a hobby, really, I created a live series with some friends called Pop-Up Magazine. And Pop-Up Magazine was writers, radio producers, photographers, and filmmakers who would perform new reported stories live on stage in all different kinds of media. This grew faster and bigger than any of us imagined until we were doing shows in large 2,000, 3,000 seat theaters. There came a moment where it was time for it to be more than a hobby. And so I was thinking, well, what all should this become? Pop-Up Magazine grew up on the West Coast, and it struck me as really strange that all of the national feature media in the United States, for the most part, is produced in New York or Washington, D.C. It's all on the East Coast. And it's strange that you'd have so many terrific magazines with the name New York in the title, and there wasn't anything quite like what we ended up creating in the California Sunday magazine. So it's we had this notion of expanding our live show and then creating a new title to live alongside it, a weekend magazine. And the idea we had was that it would be deeply digital, of course, but it wouldn't only be a creation for the web. The Los Angeles Times and the San Francisco Chronicle had mostly gotten out of the magazine business, but they had an existing line of business where you can insert things. And for the most part, that's used for commercial products. But we approached them about inserting an editorial product instead. And so we launched the California Sunday magazine in the fall of 2014, online at californiasunday.com, and also in a really beautiful print edition that goes out with Sunday editions of the LA Times and the San Francisco Chronicle, and by mail to subscribers.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to ask you about that, and because this is a story we're sort of fascinated with, and we've actually told it on the pages of Monocle magazine. I think it was back in November of 2015. There's a little picture of you and your colleagues in there then. Tell me a bit more then about the magazine, because I guess it's that distribution model, if you like, which is both incredibly innovative, but I imagine maybe, I don't know, quite challenging for some people. You know, some would say that in printed media, some people aren't necessarily that good at moving with the times. What was the response like as that idea came together? And do you think it's really, I don't know, has that woken a lot of people up as to some of the opportunities actually that are out there? This isn't necessarily a medium or a distribution model that's contracting. There's real space to grow.
Well, you know, we found a really wonderful reception for it. From the very beginning, we wanted to be dedicated to deeply reported features, photography, and design. And print as a medium is a really wonderful canvas for great photography and design. We got a lot of recognition for those things pretty quickly. And at the same time, if people visit our website, they'll see that this is not a backward-looking enterprise. There's nothing nostalgic about it. It's print is an interesting platform, an interesting business opportunity. I wouldn't want to be launching a large circulation print product on the newsstand right now, but we had this idea to kind of hack an existing distribution network and allow us to grow a print product quicker and more efficiently than if we were trying to battle on the newsstand. And we found, you know, what we weren't, you know, you never know how people are going to receive something when you bring it into the world. And we came kind of out of nowhere for a lot of people and said we're going to be covering California, the American West, Asia, and Latin America for an international audience. It's going to be online and in print with a pretty large circulation. And pretty quickly we found we had audience everywhere and we had great response from advertisers. In our first year, you were seeing ads from companies like Lexus and Apple and Google and really, I think, getting behind the idea of it.
Mm. Douglas, tell me a little bit about some of the kind of the ethos, I guess, behind the look, the feel, of the print product then? I know we're, tomorrow there'll be a new one on newsstands. I've got the December 4, 2016 issue in my hands. Listeners might hear me leafing through it. What's the sort of the overarching, is there an overarching, I don't know, creative ethos or design ethos? How would you encapsulate it? Because it struck me as interesting. I mentioned it to some colleagues that I was going to be talking to, the guy from the California Sunday magazine. Everyone in Monocle was like, oh, I love that magazine. It's so great. What's the secret?
It's great to hear. Well, from an editorial perspective, we describe the magazine really simply as it's a magazine of stories about people. We do fewer things than some magazines. We don't do reviews. We don't do essays, really. There isn't really service coverage, things telling you what to buy or where to shop, in part because we think there are outlets out there doing a great job at that, and we don't necessarily need to compete with that. But it's a magazine of stories about people. So it's we talk about our stories being cinematic. They have vivid characters. They draw you into worlds, and they use those characters and plot, like great fiction or great films, to draw you into some world or to explore some idea, oftentimes a really important idea, a difficult idea, to take you into the lives of people whose lives aren't like yours. It's a magazine for curious people. From a design standpoint, it was very important to us from the very beginning. A lot of times, magazines that are great reading experiences, magazines that really dedicate themselves to reporting, don't put as much emphasis on visual storytelling. And so we put a lot of emphasis on design from the very beginning. We put a lot of emphasis on photography. Our creative director and our photography director were our first two hires. And so if you're flipping through the print product, you'll see gigantic photography. You'll see much more photography than you would normally see in a deeply reported written feature. You'll see some unusual design features like two spread openers and full bleed spread photographs. And we really see the photography and the design as part of the storytelling, not just sort of a splashy opener and then lots of text, but really visual storytelling all the way through a story.
Now, Douglas, tell us, I mentioned that you've got your next print product out tomorrow, dropping onto people's doorsteps. Tell us, can you tell us what we've got to look forward to? What are you most excited about in your newest edition?
So our cover story, you may have heard the United States elected a guy named Donald Trump. The cover.
Yeah, it's a few people have mentioned it.
It's come up in conversation. Our cover story begins something unusual for us, and for magazines, really, it's the start of a series. We noticed in the days after the election that we were hearing talk in California that the state, which is a state, but it's also one in eight Americans lives in California. It's the sixth largest economy in the world. It's the home to Silicon Valley and Hollywood. It's a state with a lot of influence. That the state government was beginning to take steps to act as opposition to what they saw as the emerging administration in Washington. And so this is a story that's going to unfold over the course of the year, potentially over the course of years. But we decided to come out with a feature right away that chronicles the birth of this opposition, starting in the minutes after the election. And it takes you up to the present. And we've announced this as part one. So it's kind of borrowing a newspaper format. You don't normally see a series in magazines, but we'll be continuing to report the story throughout the year. And when it's time for chapter two, we'll publish chapter two. We also have a really terrific investigation, really, a narrative investigative piece about life below decks on cruise ships. Filipinos make up nearly a third of cruise ship workers, and in a lot of cases, the work they do isn't especially governed by international law, or rather, it's governed by a lowest common denominator form of international law. And so the writer did a really wonderful job taking you into life below decks of a cruise ship where thousands of people work and explaining what it's like there every day. Lots of really surprising, interesting details, like all the small businesses that people run out of their rooms, cutting hair and tattoos, and one of the people in the story runs a video store out of their room for other cruise ship employees. But it also talks about what happens when things go wrong, what happens when people get injured, what kinds of protections people have. So it's it kind of takes you into this world that you wouldn't normally have a chance to see, and reveals some things that will probably be pretty startling to readers.
Indeed. Well, we'll really look forward to reading more of that. And we'll look forward to reading the California Sunday magazine as it's with us over the coming months, Douglas. Always, it's a hot property, particularly on this side of the pond. So best of luck with tomorrow and going forward. Douglas McGray from the California Sunday magazine. Thanks for being on The Stack. And Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brûlé joins me now here in Studio One. Hi, Tyler. You seem so relaxed. What a quiet week it's been. Not much going on.
I know you seem so relaxed. It sounds like you're medicated or something. Anyway,
medicating or meditating, somewhere between the two.
It's a good place to be.
We should just mention briefly one of the reasons why it's been quite so frenetic, of course, around Midori House the last few days is we're closing in on issue 101, and there'll be much more about this on the Stack and across all Monocle's channels. But in a few short words, it's an exciting and, I don't know, quite a dynamic moment here at HQ.
It is, and I actually quite, I mean, you're in the middle of it in so many ways, given the geography of your desk on the editorial floor. But I thought your reaction was interesting because we had a board meeting earlier in the week. Some of the original investors from Sweden and Switzerland were here, and this was the first board meeting of the year. But it also marked the 10th anniversary, and we did a bit of a sneak preview showing them the evolution of the magazine. And if we do rewind about, 7-8 weeks ago, Andrew, our editor, Richard Spencer Powell, our creative director, we were in Switzerland, and we went away for just to sort of really hunker down, and talk about what we wanted to do. And I think we set out to, and this is what you've really witnessed, I think we thought, we'll go and we'll change 20 or 30% of the magazine. But I think you've seen it. We are probably changing about 70% of the magazine, and it will be all of the fonts and typography that our readers have come to love, and we're not getting rid of the black frame, but we're adding sections, and probably some favorite things are being deleted, and hopefully a lot of new favorites are being added. But there is a lot of construction going on upstairs, that's for sure.
Yeah, busy time indeed, and it will be very exciting to chart the progress, and we'll come back to that in the weeks ahead, of course. Let's just turn to news, and I don't want to trouble you further by asking about, the news agenda. It generally focuses on the incumbent in the White House, and there's enough about that across the rest of our network. But let's talk about how people are consuming their news, because this is relevant when there's so much white noise out there. And there have been some encouraging reports recently around even fans of particular news brands, and I'm talking maybe about big newspapers. It's a solid 9 out of 10 who either uniquely or certainly prefer to consume it on the printed page.
Yes.
And I guess for such a staunch advocate of the printed product, you must be delighted to see those kind of numbers.
I'm delighted to see those kind of numbers, but they're not surprising. And I think that one thing, of course, it was one of the reasons why this program was created. It was one of the reasons why we went to market with this magazine, is that we've always believed, I guess on one side, that consumers, they want options. And I always feel that in this world where, whether it's board members or it's investors or it's consultants, everyone wants to look for efficiencies. And I always talk about this unilateral world that we're in, that everyone's got to be a low-cost airline, or everyone can only read off of digital, or everyone's only going to be doing self-checkout, whatever it is. But we're just pushed down one channel. And I think we know that people, they do want choices. And maybe one day, Tom, you go to the grocery store and you don't want to talk to the lady, and you don't want them cooing over your lovely child. You just want to get out of there. And so you're going to go to self-checkout. But other days you want people to say, oh my God, look how gorgeous that little Edwards baby is. And
I don't want the self-checkout ever.
Okay,
like,
good.
That robot, but this was, I want to fight the robot that's in
but
there.
I think that, again, I think at a boardroom level, I think oftentimes people, we're looking for efficiencies and let's send everyone down one path. And I think we've known that is just not the case. And that is why I think we've been such strong advocates of giving people options. And then I think there's a whole other side. We're working on a little mini documentary about that right now, that there is a very unique relationship that you have between that tactile snap between the fingertips. And I think how that's transmitted through nerve endings up to your brain, as much as the relationship of your eyes scanning a page as well. There's a very, very different way of consuming and retaining information that happens on paper.
One thing that strikes me as really interesting, and I was reading this in the context of this report, which pointed out that interesting 90% figure. I guess some people, and probably Tolly, I imagine, when you discuss this with people, they maybe accuse you sometimes of being, I don't know, a romantic about it, or being a little naive, or being too trusting in the old mediums. But what really jumped out at me was this other piece of data. The 90 to 10 split mirrors almost exactly newspapers' print digital revenues, i.e. 90% comes from the printed page.
Absolutely.
And 10% from, it has to be the only future. And that's a really interesting overlap, and almost exactly to the point, bang on, nine to one.
Absolutely.
That's not a narrative that's told either.
Often. And I'm sitting with a big smile on my face too, because we just closed our 10th anniversary issue with 26% up on advertising from last year. And last year was a good year. So, you know, last year was a nicely profitable year for our company. And yet we've steamed ahead with, 26% up, which is okay. Yes, some people are there because it's an anniversary issue for sure. But nevertheless, you want to be in that bank of advertisers. And I think that's one thing that happens in magazines, that just only hours ago we were reviewing who are the main players that are going to be there. And it's just interesting that, you know, it's this great mix of course, luxury goods companies and airlines and hotel groups and all of the people that support our business, financial services companies, etc. And you simply, you know, that's all about adjacencies, and it's about who's in your neighborhood. And that is something that still digital hasn't been able to replicate, that, but advertisers crave it. And I think when you talk about the revenue split, that is something which, magazines, newspapers can still deliver. You know, there's been a lot of talk, obviously, about the New York Times of late, the second phase of one of their big reports they've launched. And again, if you dig down into the numbers, there was a piece earlier in the week in the Lex section of the FT analyzing the New York Times' numbers. And again, it's the same point that you're making, Tom, about looking at that sort of 90-10. When you look at the subs And of course, ad revenue and I guess, you know, and any type of other ancillary things that come with digital, it just comes close in its totality to what the New York Times still brings in print.
Exactly.
And yet a lot of fuss is still made about, you know, every new digital subscriber they, of course, are able to sign up, not paying very much money. And it's not just the New York Times. It's the story of many.
It's across the board. That's why that figure is so arresting. Tyler, we could talk all day about that. I shall leave you to the rest of your Saturday. Just tell me brief, you'll be back in London end of next week.
Yeah.
Chance to visit any favourite Brulé newsstands around the world in the meantime?
In the meantime, well, let me think.
Potentially.
I'm going, next week is Toronto. I'm going to be in Toronto. I've got to keep it on Thomas Lewis. We're working on... A very, very big project, big launch is happening on the agency side of our business, which is exciting. It involves an airline. I'll leave it at that. But everyone can certainly keep an eye on the news on Thursday, the 9th of February. Some big announcements, which will be exciting. But I'll be back in this year. If you want me to look after the show next week, I can. I'm back Friday morning, whatever you want.
The studio is yours.
I don't know if the listeners are missing me or not.
The studio is yours, Tyler, every Friday. I get lots of angry letters if it's me
good.
And not you. So you'll be back.
Excellent.
Lovely stuff. Tyler, thanks for being with us. Of course, as always. And that is all we have time for on this week's programme. My thanks to our producers, Ben Ryland and Fernando, and of course to our editor, Claire Urban. Drop Fernando a note if you have a comment or a query. He is on fp@monocle.com. Don't forget to join us at the same time next weekend. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.